Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. David Baldacci is one of the greatest thriller writers of the last two decades. He creates heroes with severe flaws, powerful people of influence are easily corruptible, or in the case of his most recent novel, Long Road to Mercy, an FBI agent with special skills assigned to the remote wilds of the southwestern United States. Baldacci wrote his first novel, Absolute Power, while working as a trial lawyer. As a result, it took him 3 years to complete. When it was finally published, Absolute Power became an overnight success and was adapted as a major motion picture starring Gene Hackman and Clint Eastwood. Now, Baldacci is the author of 40-plus novels, including The Hit, Wish You Well, and Last Man Standing. He has many series to his credit, including Camel Club, King and Maxwell, and Memory Man. He begins a new one with protagonist Atlee Pine in his latest, Long Road to Mercy, and it's a great pleasure to welcome David Baldacci to this week's book show. David, thank you very much for being with us.
Glad to be here.
It's very nice to have you on the program. I mentioned this is a new series. At what point do you think it would be nice to add somebody new to the crayon box?
That's right. Got to have something else for the repertoire. I think with Atlee Pine, one, I wanted to have a solo female protagonist lead up a series. I've written about a lot of women in the course of my books, but never one who's sort of leading a narrative. They've always been partnered with someone else. And it just felt right, a fresh start, something new. I'd had Amos Decker for four or five books now and hadn't started a series in a few years, and it just felt like the time was ripe for it.
When you have a woman like Atlee Pine, well, tell us a little bit about her. She's an FBI agent. The start of the story is very revealing as to her background, which is really one of the most horrifying things you can imagine.
Yeah, she had a very tragic childhood. She was one of twins, and her twin sister was named Mercy, and that's where the title comes from. When they were 6 years old, living in Macon, Georgia, a man came through the window and did a nursery rhyme, Eeny, Meeny, Miny, Mo. And he picked Mercy and took her and almost killed Atlee. And they haven't seen Mercy since. They have no idea if she's dead or alive. And I think one thing that drives Atlee is that she's living two lives. She's living her life and the life of her sister, who never had the chance to realize her potential.
So Atlee herself comes to life not only with that tragedy, but also with a dysfunctional family, both her mother, her father, and she becomes an FBI agent, and that, yes, is her life.
Right. She's aloof, even though in her job she has to be able to build consensus and get people to trust her. In the Southwest, she has to deal with a lot of local law enforcement agencies. She's probably the only federal agent for quite a few square miles. She has a number of major Indian tribes. They all have the local police force. She has to deal with them. But she's a loner, and she much would prefer to rely on herself. I think that's been her whole life. She's estranged from her mother. Her dad committed suicide on her birthday. They were both guilt-ridden because of what happened to Mercy. So yes, she is the height of, you know, a dysfunctional family. And I think that she dives into her job because that's the one thing she can sort of control. The rest of her life is totally out of control.
It's that and working out.
Almost made the Olympics, didn't quite get it. And I could have gone the easy route and made her an Olympic weightlifter, but I didn't want her to have that. I wanted her to come close, but she lost out on that. By a kilo, you know, a couple of pounds. That's another chip on her shoulder.
When you start reading the novel, there's a section at the beginning when she's meeting a hardened criminal who she thinks may have something to do with her sister's death, and you write about ADX Florence, which is in Colorado. Did you go there?
Yeah. I've been to lots of prisons in the course of my life, some as a writer, some as a lawyer. I could have gone to ADX Florence, but I didn't want to. I have some friends in the Justice Department. They said, you know, do you want to go to ADX Florence? And I said, I would just rather imagine it. And because I didn't want to let the real description and observations I might have had sort of, I wanted this to be a sort of a horribly magical moment, if you will, between these two people. Daniel James Torr, who I describe as probably the most prolific serial killer of his generation, and Atlee Pine. I describe the prison enough so you know it's a terrible place. The worst of the worst are there. It's not a place you'd ever want to spend any time in. But I wanted that soul scene to between these two people in a very small room with the pane of glass separating them.
Timothy McVeigh, the Unabomber,
Boston Marathon bomber,
the perpetrator of the
Oklahoma City bombing, the co-conspirator,
as well as the World Trade Center, right?
There are World Trade Center bombers there. There are cartel members there. There are mafia bosses there. A lot of them don't stay there the whole time. ADX Florence is where they send people to sort of get any type of troublemaking out of their system, and they go back to other federal security prisons. This is the only maximum security prison in the federal system. Some of them will be there for the rest of their life. People like the Unabomber probably will be at Florence forever.
When she leaves there, she goes back and starts to work on a case in the Grand Canyon. I will ask basically the same question, which is, how much time did you spend on the floor of the Grand Canyon?
The first time I ever saw the Grand Canyon, I was on a United Airlines commercial flight. We were flying over Arizona, and the pilot gets on the PA, and he says, "I am the greatest pilot in the world. I have gotten you to LAX an hour ahead of schedule. Unfortunately, they don't have a gate for us, but I've done something kind of weird. I got permission for us to drop down to 5,000 feet. I'm going to take you on a tour of the Grand Canyon." So in a commercial airliner, we drop down to 5,000 feet, and for 45 minutes, we circle the Grand Canyon. The pilot obviously knew it really well, and he was pointing out all the stuff to us. And we were going, like, from one side of the plane to the other to look out the windows. It was sort of a surreal moment. And last year, we visited the Grand Canyon just on vacation, my wife and a couple of our friends. And I'd never been physically there before. And it was a captivating place for me. And I remember the guide who took us, I was just peppering him with questions. He knew so much about the area, not just the canyon, but the surrounding areas, the Indian tribes who lived there. And going back home, I really hadn't thought about where I was going to set the new book. But then I thought, I want a woman who is a loner. I've written a lot about the East Coast. Let me take her out to the wide open space. It's probably where she prefers. And why not set it at the Grand Canyon? Because obviously it's a very important asset of the United States. FBI certainly would have some jurisdiction over it. And that it all came together.
It's fascinating because, as you mentioned, it's one of the, out of our great wonders of the world, it is the only one in the United States.
It is. Yes, it is.
And it is a magnificent place. And so a group of people, they go down to the bottom of the canyon. You do that. I know this from the Brady Bunch and your book. They go down by mule.
By mule.
And lo and behold, Atlee gets called to a case where a mule has been gutted and initials put in the side of the animal. Very grisly. And then you're off to the races.
Yeah, and the key to that is that the rider is missing. You know, there's only a handful of people come down with each of the mule rides. I think 10 is the maximum. They have one person who's missing, a guy named Benjamin Priest, and they don't know where he went. They don't know a whole lot about him, his background, but obviously it's her job to find out what happened to this guy. It was a terrible thing what happened to the mule, but obviously they need to find the person. And once Atlee finds out that Benjamin Priest is not really Benjamin Priest, and when the upper echelons of the FBI start to say, you know, you need to be called off this case, go take a vacation, this is done, then, you know, she has to make a choice. She can either do what they tell her to do, or she can go the Atlee Pine way. And she just kind of goes maverick and decides to solve it on her own.
How common is that in your, I mean, obviously for fiction telling, it's wonderful, but in the agency of people working a case is saying, maybe you should take some time off.
Yeah. You know, in politically sensitive cases, we have seen a lot of the FBI interaction with a lot of things going on in Washington right now.
And, right.
Let's put it this way. Some FBI agents have been given very long vacations permanently, whether you think that's right or wrong. But so there is, politics plays a role there. And the FBI is part of the Justice Department. The Justice Department is part of the executive branch. There's a direct connection between politics and the people who wear the badge. So, you know, it happens.
So in this office that Atlee Pine is at, it's just her and her assistant. Her assistant harkens back to Hoover, right?
Yeah, she likes J. Edgar Hoover. Never met him, but that's a little bit tongue-in-cheek. I started it out because I wanted people just have to work hard to figure out Carol Blum, the assistant.
Yeah.
So I thought, okay, J. Edgar Hoover, everybody sort of, you know, the thoughts are, oh my God, you know, straight laced but kind of creepy and all that. But that's not really who she turns out to be. In this book, I didn't want, in a lot of thrillers, you have two guys as a partner, a guy and a girl as a partner. You almost never have two women partnering, particularly women, one in her 30s and one in her 60s. This is kind of my sort of Thelma and Louise kind of
right.
thing here. And I wanted to write those. I wanted to write that role because that was a challenge for me as a male writer to write really authentically about two women from different generations interacting.
Two things. One is that when people say about the twists and turns of your books, that was one for me. I didn't expect Carol to then become such an integral part of the story, which was really fun because they're a hoot together.
Yes.
And then also about writing two female protagonists. Robert B. Parker once told me, when I asked him the question, he was writing a Sonny Randall novel, one of his protagonists, and I said, what is it like to write in the female voice? And he said, I realized that if I had to ask myself what it was like, I couldn't do it.
Right. I tell people that I feel comfortable writing sort of from a female point of view just because I grew up surrounded by females. My maternal grandmother lived with us for the last 10 years of her life. I spent pretty much every day with her. My mother was a force of nature. My sister is a journalist and writer in her own right, very independent. I'm married to a force of nature. We raised a very independent daughter. I have like 18 aunts from both sides. That I knew and spent a lot of time with growing up. So, and the families would all get together and the women would interact. And I just sat and observed and watched it all. So I felt comfortable sort of attacking that relationship in a book like this because I felt like I'd lived it.
Atlee Pine is the protagonist in the new novel, Long Road to Mercy, which is just out from Grand Central. David Baldacci is our guest on this week's book show. When it comes to the creation not only of this character but of a series, I assume you have the long game in mind.
You really have to allow yourself ultimate latitude and flexibility, particularly in the first book. I lay out some teasers. The first chapter is a teaser. The last chapter is a teaser for that. And those are questions that are not going to be resolved or answered in any significant way in this novel. And at the same time, I throw out the fact that she's estranged from her mother. I throw out the fact that her father committed suicide on his daughter's birthday as sort of a symbol of his own failure. So there's a lot of, I call them, you know, Easter eggs that I've laid in this book that will only have greater significance in subsequent books. I haven't figured out what the arc is going to be. I haven't figured out what the additional plots are going to be. But I know in this first book it was important for me to really be flexible and lay out some stuff, knowing that they weren't going to be resolved.
So in other words, it sounds like you set it up for yourself to
yes.
say, oh, okay, well, then I'll throw this in and then I'll worry about that later.
Yeah, you know, I can't plot out every book that she's going to be in. I haven't done that with any of the series. My books really grow organically. I just finished the latest Amos Decker before I started this tour for the spring. And a really neat twist very near the end of the book only occurred to me very near the end of the book, because sometimes you'll set a framework up in a story that has opportunities throughout and potential. And as you're writing the story and you get deeper and deeper into it and your mind is working completely and you get towards the end and you realize that framework will support this idea I just thought of. I don't have to go back and change anything because it fits nicely into what I've already created and can come out of it very plausibly. And so the twist that I came up with, you know, I put in because the opportunity was there from the framework that I'd laid. And that's not things really that you can think of from day one. With Atlee Pine, a brand new character, how in the world could I outline the whole book? I hadn't even met her yet on the page. I didn't know what she was capable of. Like you said, Carol Blum, maybe in the back of my mind, Carol was just going to be a secretary in the beginning, and they weren't going to have this, you know, kind of cool relationship. But as I got more into the book and I got a feel for Carol, I thought, you know, there's more potential there than maybe I might have imagined. And that's why I tell, you know, aspiring writers, allow yourself flexibility. If you want to do an outline, do an outline. And a lot of writers I know, I have really good friends who are incredibly successful. They outline the whole book from beginning to end. It works for them. That's great. I'm just saying that you can find your own groove and own way to do it. And if outlines don't work for you, don't feel like you're missing out on something. Just go with what you think and go with your instinct. And sometimes let the story grow organically.
It seems that people who write, obviously not all, but many who write crime thrillers, mysteries, however you want to identify them. You have a lot of former journalists. They have a lot of former crime journalists. You have a lot of former lawyers. You have a lot of former DAs, judges, who want to write the story. What do you think it is, you being, having been an attorney, of the want to tell a story, the want to write fiction and to ultimately write about what you know?
I think a lot of the two professions, legal and writing, share a lot of similar attributes. As a lawyer, I was a trial lawyer for the bulk of my career, and my job was to do two things. It was to piece out a puzzle, to take a little pieces of information and fact and put the puzzle together so it made sense. And that's what you do when you're building a plot. And then I had to build a story that I was going to convey to a judge, for instance, or a jury. And I had to tell them the story. I was using the same set of facts the other side had. You know, the trial record is the trial record. You can't change that. So how can you argue diametrically opposed positions using the same set of facts? Well, you write a story that benefits your client within ethical considerations. You hype up certain elements and you downplay others that aren't as favorable to your client. But you're telling a story and you want the fact finder to look at you and say, you know what, I believe your version of the facts. Your story is more compelling than the other side's. So when you're sitting down to write a novel, you're putting the pieces all together. You know it's going to be long term. I think one of the best things I had going for me as a lawyer was that I'd always done a lot of research as a lawyer. I do a lot of research for my novels. But lawyering taught me patience. And I knew that I wasn't going to write a book over a weekend and then sell the movie rights. It just wasn't going to happen. As a lawyer, every day I went in and I laid a brick in the wall, and then I went home and thought about it and came back the next day and put another brick in. That's exactly what I do as a writer.
But now you can do that, right?
I can do that.
But in the rock, paper, scissors that is professions, writer beats lawyer, right?
Yeah, I mean, as a lawyer, I was never in control of my own professional life. I was always writing at the whim of somebody else or, you know, a client telling me to do this or that. These days, you know, I get up every day and I decide how I'm going to spend my day, which is a fantastic privilege. And I feel very, very fortunate to be able to do it.
Because of the people who have been successful writers, who have been attorneys or whatever they were, they don't seem to stay in that job.
No. I mean, the only one I know who does it still is Scott Turow.
Scott Turow,
I saw Scott at the National Book Festival, and we correspond back and forth. He's a great guy and great writer. And he was telling me, he said, you know, you publish so much more frequently than I do. And I said, Scott, you still practice law, you know, because he loves it and he does a lot of great work. And I think he does about a half year's worth, but that's still a lot. And then writes great books on top of that. But for the most part, you know, people like Grisham and others and myself, I think we left the profession. I never regretted practicing law. It taught me a lot of good skills that I use to this day. My publisher lament the fact that I actually read and understand the publishing contracts, and that's why I changed them all. Because, you know, as far as writers go, they suck.
So is there a, when you think about the writing life and what you're doing, do you ever think about us in the sense of why do people enjoy these stories? Why do people love this genre?
I was over in the UK in the spring, and during some interviews, I was told, my publisher told me too, that this year, that crime fiction is what they call it over there. Crime fiction overtook all other fiction as the most popular form of fiction in the UK. And I know over here, you can call it mystery, thriller, crime fiction, whatever you want. It's probably one of the most popular. If you look at the bestseller list, you could probably say maybe it's the most popular. There's usually five or six thriller or mystery writers on the list at any given time. I think, you know, over time, but maybe particularly these days too, if people can't find justice and right wins out over wrong and wrong is punished in real life, they search for it elsewhere. And they'll search for it maybe in music, they'll search for it in television, they search for it in movies, and they also search for it greatly in books. You know, typical mystery or thriller, you have a protagonist, an antagonist, something happens, someone is hurt, someone is trying to find the truth, and at the end, typically the truth wins out, and the person who committed the bad deed is punished. And that's the way, if you think in a fair world, that's the way things should play out. I think when people find they can't find that anywhere in the real life anymore, that genre becomes even more popular because it sort of substitutes for that void that people feel in real life. And I think maybe in the UK, with a lot of things going over there, that people feel like they feel lost and confused, and they have no idea why their life has been turned upside down with Brexit and other things. And over here, you know, people maybe feel that same way politically. You have heroes. People want heroes. They want people to win out. And they want the person who did something wrong to be punished and have consequences for it.
And, of course, this has long been a very popular genre, and we've always wanted those heroes, I guess. When it comes to the understanding of your readers and what they ultimately want from you, do you think about that a lot?
I never have sat down and, you know, said what would be popular for me to write. And when I, you know, talk with, you know, new writers, aspiring writers, I said, look, don't chase trends.
Mm-hmm.
I said when you know, Jurassic Park came out, I can tell you, because I was trying to write screenplays back then, every screenplay written after Jurassic Park came out had a dinosaur in it. It could have been a romantic comedy, and you would have a T-Raptor breaking in on the dinner. The problem is they didn't need that because they had Michael Crichton in his franchise. So when I tell people, write about, the old adage is write what you know about, I said I would modify that slightly, and I'd say write about what you'd like to know about. If you're fascinated with a particular subject, passionate about it, go in there and learn as much as you can, and that passion will come out in your prose and in your plots. So instead of trying to figure what's popular, what do I think my readers, you know, would like in me next time, I sit down and I say, what really drives me at this point? Because I know the most important thing is for me to feel motivated and energized and passionate and interested in what I'm writing about. Otherwise, I'm going to write a bad book. And then the readers aren't going to like it anyway, so I've sort of lost out. Regardless of whether I think they're going to like it or not, I need to charge up myself. And I think that's one reason why I try to keep challenging myself, writing new series, setting it in different places, going into different genres, writing a brand new character like Atlee Pine. That keeps me fresh and challenged and energized. And that's the best way to capture your readers and keep them.
You are at a level that some authors have said, okay, we can go from what we're doing right now and make it a brand.
Right.
You haven't done that.
No. I mean, lots of people talk to me about the brands, the Baldacci brand and all that stuff. And I think about it a lot more simply. For me, it always begins and ends with the story. I don't care if you call it a brand or what, but all I know is that when I sit down to write a book, I want to write the best book that I can because I want to enjoy telling the story. If I don't have any fun writing the story, the readers are not going to enjoy it. And so I've always sat down with a mission of however long it takes me to write this book, I'm going to have a blast doing it. Not to say it's not hard work and not to say that some days it's frustrating as hell because the words just won't come. But at the end, I'm going to be glad that I did it. And if I keep to that same basic position, then I think I'm going to do okay.
And you have written it.
I have written it.
Yeah. It's yes. Your words.
Yes, my
and
words.
It's your story.
You're never gonna see another name on my cover of my book. You
right.
know, as I tell, I don't play well with others.
Well, isn't that why writers become writers? I would say the same thing about people in radio. There's a reason that I chose a profession where I'm in a room all by myself.
Yes, it is. Because sharing that with someone or having someone write it and you just sort of look over their work, again, going back to my last point, it takes all the fun out of it. And then what's the point? I might as well go off and do something else.
You're still having fun doing this.
I have a blast. Every day I get up. I'm only unhappy when I'm between stories. Mm. If I don't have something to write about, I feel lost.
But it doesn't seem like you, I don't know, but it doesn't seem like you hit that point too often, does it?
Not very often. I mean, I just finished the Amos Decker book, but before I finished it, I just had, on a whim, I had an idea for a short story, and I just started writing that, and that's something I'm working on now. So even though I haven't started the next book after Amos Decker, I have something to write on. I have a toy to play with.
One of your standalone novels was Wish You Well. Wish You Well Foundation is something very much a part of your life. Tell us a little bit about that original story and what led to the foundation.
Yeah, the Wish You Well is a book set in the 1940s in Southwest Virginia. It sort of mirrors my maternal family's and my mother growing up there in the middle of nowhere on top of a mountain. I'd visited there as a kid many, many times. My grandmother, who lived there, lived with us for, you know, a decade before she passed away. So I got a lot of stories about that. And even though the story in Wish You Well is fictional, the place setting is not. That's how my mother grew up, rough and tumble. And it was just a very hard scrabble life with a lot of challenges. The Wish You Well Foundation, we named it after the book because we feel like we support literacy organizations and initiatives across the country. We put a lot of money into it. we feel like if we can teach people to read at a higher level, we are actually wishing them well. It's the most fundamentally important skill anybody could have. And it goes beyond reading the next bestseller on the beach. If you can't read at a high level, there's no way you can be a fully functioning participant in democracy. You can't be a full citizen because you won't be able to come up with your own ideas and opinions, process information that you get. And being from Washington, D.C., I can tell you flat out that if you don't come up with your own opinions, there are a lot of really well-paid people who will tell you exactly what you're supposed to think and how you're supposed to vote. And I don't think that's a good thing.
You can find out more information about the foundation by going to wishyouwellfoundation.org, wishyouwellfoundation.org. The name of the new book is Long Road to Mercy. It is an Atlee Pine thriller. David Baldacci, great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for spending time with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
David Baldacci's new thriller is Long Road to Mercy. It is published by Grand Central. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.